Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Gary Ostrower examines the origins of World War II and discusses the major battles, turning points, and countries involved. Also detailed are the numbers of those killed in specific offensives and the type of tactics and weaponry used. This hour and 40-minute class is from a course on modern Western history and took place at Alfred University in New York.
Okay, we're talking about the Second World War today. This is a survey lecture on the Second World War. It's a very, very big subject, and I hope that we can cover it all within the context, within the time limit that we have right now. I do want to just kind of begin with an observation. And my observation is that last week there were about nine NATO soldiers, including some Americans, who were killed in Afghanistan. And when that happens, it's front page news in this country. During the Second World War, if there were nine GIs who were killed on any given day, that would also be front page news, not because of the nine who were killed, but because the nine represent such a very, very peaceful day during the Second World War. I was going to begin with a more or less narrative of the war. Instead, what I'm going to do is to provide my conclusions at the beginning of this lecture and then turn to the narrative of the war itself. I want to begin first by making a general comment about what I consider to be one of the most important single characteristics of the war, which is its destructiveness. We don't know how many people died during the Second World War. Our best guess is that somewhere between about 45 million and about 60 million. And that number is abstract. It's kind of hard to fully comprehend. It's difficult to fully understand that. But the fact of the matter is that it was a hugely, hugely destructive war, much more destructive than any other war ever fought. And there have been plenty of destructive wars, including the 30 Years' War back in the 17th century and so forth. In 1937, 1938, there was horror at the notion that aerial bombardment of cities might threaten civilians. By 1945, we took that kind of aerial bombardment for granted. As a matter of fact, we didn't simply take it for granted, we more or less celebrated it. The Germans celebrated it, the Allies celebrated it, cities like Hamburg, cities like Dresden, Hamburg in 1943, Dresden in 1945, were pretty much obliterated, at least in the center portions of those cities. In Hamburg, about 40,000 people died in the course of just 4 days. In Dresden, somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 25,000 to 30,000 people died over the course of 2 days. In Hamburg, there was a firestorm. In a very literal sense, the air caught fire. It was so hot that the air caught fire. And to sustain that kind of a fire, you need oxygen. And to sustain that kind of oxygen, we're going to draw it from every conceivable building, including, I might add, from air raid shelters. So that of the 40,000 people in Hamburg who died, most of them died as a result of suffocation, asphyxiation. In other words, they simply didn't have enough oxygen to breathe, and that's because the oxygen was just sucked into this, what was called a firestorm. Nazi racial policies, which we'll talk about later, had much to do with the large percentage of people, large number of people who were killed during the war. As a matter of fact, I think it's worth noting that most of the people who died during World War II, in contrast to World War I, most of the people who died were civilians. That was in part because of the Holocaust. There were 5 million other civilians that the Nazis killed. There are many, many soldiers and others who were killed by the Russians, including German POWs and so forth. Secondly, I want to make the point that, like World War I, World War II would also be a war of machines, which is quite different from, you know, earlier wars. We talked about the arrival of new machines during World War I in an earlier lecture, the appearance of the tank, of planes, of poison gas, of submarines and so forth and so on. In World War II, you really did not have so much the appearance of new weapons so much as you had the development and the, quote, improvement of existing weapons, and they became that much more lethal in the process. There were some new items. Radar, for instance, was new during World War II. Radios on the battlefield became much, much more plentiful than they had in World War I. Thirdly, I want to make a comment, if I may, about those Nazi racial policies. We know the Holocaust, okay? At least we are familiar with it in large measure as a result of the liberation of the concentration camps by Allied soldiers, the Russians in the East, the Americans and the British in the West in the latter part of 1944. And especially into 1945. By the same token, those Nazi racial policies resulted in the deaths of quite literally millions, not thousands, but millions of Russian POWs during the war. I think it's important to understand that when we talk about Nazi racial policies, we're talking about, among other things, anti-Semitism. And the reason I mention anti-Semitism is because it was central, not peripheral, but absolutely central to what Nazism represented. One historian has said that it represented this anti-Semitism, the departure of Germany from the community of civilized people. The concentration camp, in some ways, becomes the symbol of Nazi Germany, and certainly the symbol of the Holocaust itself. And I might also note that the Allies, in many ways, ignored this situation. They ignored this issue over the course of most of the war. Not really until 1944 and 1945 is there going to be any sustained attention on the part of the Allies to this racial issue during the war. For instance, the fact of the matter is that the Allies did not open their doors, not in Britain, not in the United States, not elsewhere. Did they open their doors to the Jewish refugees who were trying to flee Germany during the 1930s and into the 1940s? And in saying this, and saying that, for instance, a ship by the name called the St. Louis, carrying 907 Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany in 1939, just before the war begins, went to Cuba, was not permitted to disembark its passengers in Cuba. So it went up to Miami, okay, it floated up to Miami. The American officials refused to allow the passengers to be disembarked. And so the ship eventually made its way back to Europe, and it made its way back to Europe in a fashion where it unloaded the passengers in Belgium, and by 1945, one half of those passengers were dead. One half of them had been sent to concentration camps such as Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and others where they died. And in saying this, I want to make a point because it has to do, in a sense, with later history. You can't understand the history of Israel without understanding something about World War I and something about World War II. World War I made the State of Israel possible. When the British enunciated something called the Balfour Declaration, saying that the Jews had the right to a homeland in Palestine, that makes that homeland possible. But World War II, the way in which the Nazis handled the Jewish issue in Germany, and of course the relatively unsympathetic reception of all of that in the United States, that would really make the State of Israel necessary. There was no place where the Jews could find refuge. Had there been in Israel back in 1939 and 1940 or 1941, many, many of those Jews who died in Europe during the war would not have died at all. I want to mention something, if I may, about industrialism. The war was in many ways an industrial war. The United States, for instance, during World War II, would manufacture 360,000 planes. We would manufacture in Russia. The Russians would manufacture over 136,000 tanks. Again, these numbers are difficult to fully grasp. They were out of proportion to anything which, in an industrial sense, had been produced in earlier wars. The United States, by November of 1942, 1 year after we had been bombed into the war, we were producing submarines faster than the Germans and the Japanese together could sink our submarines. The point, in other words, words is that it was going to be military equipment that in many ways would win this war. And not only win the war for the United States, but win the war to a certain extent for the British and for the Russians. 10% of all Russian military equipment was made in the United States. In Great Britain, that number would go up to around 60 or 70% by the end of the war. Intelligence. And I wonder if I can get this... That's a comment on the Nazi concentration camps. Again, on the Nazi concentration camps. And these are code machines, okay? This is Bletchley Park, where the British had broken the German code. You can see the Japanese purple code over there. The Enigma machine. The Enigma machine. The Enigma was the main German code machine that was broken by initially by the Poles and by the British together at the early part of the year. At the early part of the war. And I mention that because from that point on, for most of the rest of the war, from 1940 right until 1945, the British and the Americans together pretty much knew when the Germans and eventually when the Japanese would be making military moves and where those moves would be directed. In other words, we knew a great deal about what they had hoped to keep secret. It's an important little element. It's a very, very important little element to an understanding of why the war turns out the way that it does. The British machine is called Ultra. Their ability to break the German code is called the Ultra Secret. And when the Americans are dealing with the Japanese code, which we broke actually before December of 1941, we're going to call our system that of magic. The next point I want to make is one about coalition warfare. Like World War I, World War II was a coalition war, certainly from the Allied perspective. Our coalition, the American coalition, included, of course, Great Britain. It included Russia. It included the United States. It included a large number of other smaller countries. It's difficult to fight a coalition war. And yet we fought that coalition war effectively, and I'm going to argue here that one of the reasons we fought it as effectively as we did is because of the skill of Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower was the American commander of forces in Europe, not only American forces, but all Allied forces in Europe. He was a superb politician, in a sense. He was less of a battlefield commander, less of a tactical commander, than he was a guy who was able to keep together a very fractious coalition of countries. He did it successfully, and I think that he deserves a great deal of the credit for the ultimate Allied victory. He was able to get the Allies to subordinate ideology and to subordinate, to a certain extent, even personality to the common purpose of winning the war. Not such an easy process. I want to also note that World War II begins the process of decolonization. That's really, in some ways, a post-World War II development. But it would not have occurred without World War II. And the reason is simply this, that World War II weakened, in a very, very serious way, it weakened the colonial powers of Europe. France was very, very seriously weakened by the war. Great Britain was weakened by the war. Those are the two countries that had the largest colonial, they had the largest empires, but by no means the only countries. Belgium had an empire that was certainly affected by World War II. It's no accident, for instance, that India would declare its independence from Great Britain in 1947. No accident that Indonesia, what today we know as Indonesia, but back in that period was known as the Dutch East Indies, would declare its independence just 2 years later in 1949. That would not have happened without World War II, and it wouldn't have happened without World War II because all of those Allied countries were very, very seriously weakened by the war itself. They may have gone in as great powers, but they didn't exit that war as great powers. The war creates, I think, a sense of American omnipotence. The United States entered that war in 1941. We're only involved in a serious way over the course of approximately 3.5 years or so. But by 1945, May, when the Germans surrendered, August, when the Japanese surrendered, American power, industrial power, military power, American power had really in some ways shaped, in many, many ways shaped, the ultimate outcome of that war. We came to see ourselves as omnipotent. And what I mean by omnipotent, of course, is a sense of being all-powerful, that we could not be defeated, that we were so powerful that no country on earth, not a Russia, not a China, not a resurgent Japan or a Germany, could defeat the United States in war. Is that important? That sense of omnipotence, the answer is yes. Why is it important? Because, among other things, it's going to lead the United States into military ventures in the post-war period that I suspect might not have been fought at all, these military ventures, without that sense of omnipotence. I'd argue, for instance, that if you want to understand the Vietnam War, you have to understand something about that American sense of omnipotence. The war is also... The war is also going to usher in the atomic age. And I want to note that while we develop atomic weapons, and while beginning in 1949, the Russians developed their first atomic weapons, and the British 3 years later, and eventually the Chinese, and probably the Israelis, and a whole bunch of other countries, Iran attempting to do so right now. The fact of the matter is that nuclear weapons may well have made war in the post-1945 period, at least war between the great powers and among the great powers, less likely than more likely. In other words, the threat of nuclear war, the very, very terrible threat of nuclear war, made an actual conflict between the great powers, I think, a good deal less likely than would otherwise have been the case. The war creates bipolarity. By the end of the war, there are, in fact, only two great powers left. At the beginning of the war, there were a bunch of great powers. Germany was considered a great power. Japan, Italy, France, England, obviously the United States. All of these countries were great powers. Russia, of course. By the end of the war, only the Soviet Union and the United States could legitimately be considered great powers. And that would pretty much remain the case until the end of the Cold War in 1949. So in that sense, again, World War II is going to have a very, very decisive influence on shaping the world that emerges from 1945. The war is going to create, if you will, or at least create the conditions for the United Nations in the post-war years. The United Nations replaces what many people consider to be the failed League of Nations that had been established in 1919. And the League of Nations, after all, had failed to prevent World War II. And by failing to prevent World War II, the League was judged a failure. And that failure was simply too important to ignore. Out of the ashes of the Second World War would arise the United Nations. The war is going to destroy, at least the United States and the Russians, are going to destroy much of the industrial capacity of both Germany and Japan during the period between 1939 and 1945. And as a result, when Germany and Japan rebuild their industries, when they rebuild their urban centers, when they rebuild their factories after World War II, they're going to do so with new plant. They're going to do so with new equipment. They're going to become more efficient at producing things like steel and even automobiles than the countries that had defeated them in the war. And the economic success, to the extent that that is an economic success story for those countries, will itself be, in an ironic way, a product of the fighting between 1939 and 1945. And lastly, I would simply make the point that the Cold War is going to emerge out of the hot war that was fought, that we call World War II. Now, that's, in a sense, the conclusion. That tells you the effect of World War II on the later period. But I want to now, if I may, turn to a comment about the roots of World War II. Why was it fought? The countries of this world, many of them, had already fought World War I. They had been exhausted by World War I. I dare say they had been horrified by the carnage of World War I, which had killed off somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 9 or 10 million people or so, most of them, I might add, on the battlefield, most of them soldiers. So why do it again only 20 years later or so? And I think to answer that question, one has to note the following. Number one, the great empires that went into World War I, the great empires that in some ways helped to create World War I, were gone, okay? They disappeared by the end of that war. Between 1914 and 1919, the German Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and I dare say the Russian Empire, had all been shattered. And out of the shattering of those empires emerged a number of new and relatively weak states. And the fact that they were relatively weak in some ways made them much more vulnerable to the designs of Adolf Hitler and others as well during the 1920s, and especially during the 1930s. In other words, the fragmentation of Europe after World War I makes World War II, is one of the factors that makes World War II more likely. Secondly, the Versailles Conference. The Versailles Conference treated Germany quite harshly. Not as harshly, I might add, as the Germans had treated the Russians at the end of World War I, but harshly enough so that the Germans refused to accept the verdict that was rendered by Versailles and wanted to essentially reverse Versailles. German resentment became then an important element in the making of World War II. Thirdly, I would mention that the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the instability that follows from that Russian Revolution in 1917 itself becomes then another element in the making of, ultimately, of World War II. Among other things, Hitler is going to design a good deal of his own policies and certainly his propaganda in opposition to that new, you know, Russian Revolution, that new Soviet Revolution. The Russian Revolution created instability in Europe, and that instability in Europe became then a factor in the politics of the 20s and especially the 30s. The new German Republic that emerges out of World War I, called the Weimar Republic, that new German Republic was, I think we could all agree, a weak republic. Weak militarily, weak politically, and ultimately unable to resist the forces of nationalism, the forces of Nazism that are going to essentially replace it during the early 1930s. I would note, too, something that we kind of take for granted, but we shouldn't take for granted, and that is the rise of the United States and of Japan as world powers. Until 1914, I think it's fair to say that most politics that we'd study in a course like this, the course in Western civilization, most politics was European. But by 1914, the Americans become involved increasingly to the point where, of course, we enter the First World War in 1917. The Japanese are going to enter the First World War in 1915. In other words, what I'm saying is that we're no longer talking about European politics. We now really are talking about world politics, and that's why World War II is going to have the very, very extensive boundaries that it does. The U.S. and Japan, in other words, are going to, in some very, very important ways, just change the definitions of international politics during those years. One should not ignore the arrival of and the appearance of fascism in the period between 1922, when Mussolini takes over in Italy, and of course 1933, when Hitler is going to engineer a kind of revolution in Germany. Fascism was an ideological challenge to the West. It was an ideological challenge to the liberal democracies. It was an ideological challenge which, among its more important characteristics, included the need for expansion, militarism, imperialism, and struggle. In other words, viewing war, viewing conflict, as in a positive fashion rather than in a negative fashion. To put it in a slightly different way, fascism was built on a foundation of social Darwinism. The idea, in other words, that conflict and fighting was a positive rather than a negative characteristic. And we're going to see likewise that during the interwar period, the years between 1919 and 1939, the structure of peace that had been created to make sure that there would not be another World War I, that structure of peace is going to disappear. That structure of peace is going to simply it's going to be superseded. So things like the League of Nations, things like the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which supposedly made aggressive war illegal, things like the Washington Conference treaties, which said that in the Far East there shall be no challenge to the the status quo. All of these things are going to go by the wayside during the 1930s. What comes out of the 1930s, then, is going to be a challenge to that status quo, and what's also going to be a great deal of instability. And let's not forget the Great Depression, okay? Let's not forget the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, and you're seeing up here on the left a bread line, it's about 5 or 6 or 7 men wide, and it extends, though you don't see it here, it extends entirely around a city block, okay? We complain today that our unemployment rate in the United States is in the neighborhood of 8 to 9%, and maybe the real unemployment rate, something greater than that. Back during the Great Depression, the unemployment rate in the United States, certainly by 1932, was 25%. 1 out of every 4 workers was out of work. And 1 out of every 4 workers was underemployed, employed part-time, not enough work to do, and so forth. In other words, the Great Depression, not only in the United States, but in Europe, created anxiety, and it created an additional instability. And in Germany, it created the conditions. In Germany, it created the conditions that led to the election of Hitler. Hitler may not have gotten a majority of the vote in 1932 and early 1933, but he did get a very, very substantial minority that he was able to use as a stepping stone to power. And my point then here is that with Hitler, not only do you have Hitler in a sense capitalizing on the fact that you had a depression, but you also have a program in Germany of rearmament. Germany is not going to suffer from unemployment in the way that many of its rivals are going to suffer from unemployment, because people were put back to work in a rearmament program, which begins as early as 1933, and of course is one of the factors which leads to war in 1939. And by the same token, Hitler is going to embark on a program of expansion. What you see here is the results in some ways of German expansion. What we have is appeasement. And when I say appeasement, I mean that policy that was supported by the Allies, a little bit by the US, but mainly by the British and the French, not to challenge the expansionist policies of Germany and not to challenge the expansionist policies of Italy. Why not? Why not challenge them? Because the British and the French were afraid of another World War I, because they had suffered such large losses during World War I that they simply were willing to go to great lengths to appease, literally to appease the dictators of Europe in order to prevent World War II. And so that brings us to Munich. It brings us to the Nazi ability to dismember Czechoslovakia, okay, on the east. When I say to dismember, in other words, to carve another country apart and to be given the right to do so, so to speak, by both the British and the French. And what Hitler learned from that was, quite evident. What Hitler learned from that was that the Allies are willing to appease the Germans on a program of expansion. And so if the Germans can carve up Czechoslovakia, presumably they can do the same thing with Poland. And when they try to do it with Poland, shortly thereafter, it led directly to war. Because finally, after a long period, the British and the French had understood that Hitler was different, that Hitler wasn't a traditional European politician, that Hitler was not a traditional politician in the sense that politicians understand limits. There were no limits to Hitler's expansionism. There were no limits to the degree to which Hitler was willing to violate earlier treaties and so forth. And so the British and the French officials had said by 1939 that if the Germans attack Poland, they, the British and the French, will go to war. And that's exactly what they did on September 1st of 1939 when Hitler attacked Poland. And so they went to war. But not before, and this is really kind of important, and I hope that this is going to get me to where I want to be without too much difficulty here, but not before the Nazi-Soviet Pact was signed. And the Nazi-Soviet Pact was an agreement, if you will, a treaty that was signed between the Germans on one hand and the Russians on the other. And what it essentially said was this, that if Germany goes to war, Russia will remain neutral. If Russia should go to war, Germany remain neutral. What's the importance of that? It meant that Hitler understood that if he did attack Poland, Russia was not going to fight Germany. Russia was not going to challenge the movement of Germany into Eastern Europe, or to put it in a slightly different way. And this is one of the more important points that I'm going to make today. The Hitler-Soviet Pact meant that if there were to be Second World War, Germany would not be fighting a two-front war. Germany would not be exhausted by a two-front war in the same way that Germany had indeed been exhausted by a two-front war back in 1914 and 15 and 16 and 17. And as a result of that, on September 1st, the Germans marched into Poland. They concocted a Polish attack on Germany. They dressed up some German criminals, literally some criminals in Polish army uniforms. They, quote, attacked, end quote, a German radio station on over the German border, and the Germans used that as an excuse to start the war. The Germans then, within a period of just 3 weeks, occupied approximately 60% of Poland, and the Russians a few weeks later then completed the job by occupying the remaining 40% of Poland. Or to put it in a slightly different way, neither the Germans nor the Russians granted the Poles, if you will, the right to exist. Okay, they never really accepted the legitimacy of Poland, not after 1919. They did not accept the legitimacy of Poland, and they snuffed out Poland at that point. Now, having said that, I want to turn for a minute to something else, and that is the war in Asia. I should add, by the way, that the war in Europe, before I turn back to Asia, the war in Europe is going to be not much of a war from September 1939, when Poland was conquered, until the early part of 1940. On April of 1940, the war in Europe and Western Europe is going to pick up. But until that time, it was kind of a phony war. The British didn't attack the Germans. The French didn't attack the Germans. They had declared war on Germany, but they didn't attack the Germans. The Germans didn't attack them. It's what we call a period of phony war. In Japan, something different. One of the points I want to stress today is that when we talk about World War II, we really should be talking about world wars, plural, rather than a world war. Okay? The world war in the Far East, the world war in the Pacific, begins not in 1939. It begins in 1937. It begins when the Japanese are going to attack the Chinese in Shanghai in July of 1937. But there are some historians, and I think for good reason, who are going to argue that if you really want to trace the origins of that war, you should go all the way back to 1931, when the Japanese attacked not Shanghai, but attacked Manchuria, which represents the three most northeastern provinces in China. The Japanese created a kind of phony incident there, where supposedly the Chinese had attacked a Japanese-controlled railroad. Again, it was every bit as phony as what the Germans did in 1939 with the Poles. They used it as an excuse to begin a war. They occupied Manchuria within a period of about 2 years. Over the course of that time, they would withdraw from the League of Nations. They would repudiate the treaties that they had earlier signed to make that kind of an attack less likely. The fact of the matter is that the Asian War really does begin in 1931. It kind of goes to a lull. And then again in 1937, we see it picking up. And the point I want to make about 1937 is simply this, that from 1937 in July until 1945, after atomic weapons obliterate Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese are involved in a major land war in China. In other words, what I'm arguing here is that, yeah, we usually say that the Second World War began in 1939, only true for Europe. In 1937, it extended a little bit earlier, and it was a very, very bloody war. In 1937, toward the end of the year, the Japanese attacked Nanking. They attacked Nanking, one of the major Chinese cities, capital city. They attacked Nanking, and they committed what historians call the Rape of Nanking. They killed hundreds of thousands of people. Our best guess is that about 250,000 people were killed in Nanking. And the vast majority of those who were killed were innocent civilians. They had nothing to do as such with the war effort. That attack, in some ways, is going to come to symbolize, in some ways, the Japanese role in the Second World War, generally. And they were killed, I might add, in an aerial bombardment of the city. It's the first time that Europe, it's the first time that Americans, it's the first time that Asians had a really good view of what aerial bombardment of cities really meant. And why this war? Why did the Japanese attack? The answer is because they, as the Germans, wanted to extend their influence in Europe, so the Japanese wanted to extend their political and their economic and their strategic influence in Asia. They wanted what they called a Japanese Monroe Doctrine. And when I say a Monroe Doctrine, I mean in the same way that the Japanese argued that the Americans had extended our influence over the entire Western Hemisphere via the Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century. So the Japanese wanted to do something very similar in Asia. They wanted their own Monroe Doctrine. And they did extend their influence over a very, very wide area. The German victories of the early part of World War II over Poland, eventually over Norway, over Denmark, over France, okay? Those German victories encouraged the Japanese in the period after 1939 to extend their own role in that war, including their decision to attack the Americans and their decision to attack the Dutch and to attack the British, as they did, of course, in 1941. Now, you might ask yourself, well, wait a minute. Why would the Americans seek to prevent the Japanese from extending their influence in China if, in fact, we had already extended our influence over so much of Latin America? And I think that there are a number of different answers to that question, but one of them has to do with economics. It's interesting to me that the only country with which the United States increased its trade during the Great Depression was China. China wasn't critical to American economic success, but it was important to American economic prosperity. And for that reason, we certainly did not want the Japanese pushing the Americans and certainly the British and perhaps others out of China itself. I think that's some of it, okay? In other words, what I'm offering you is a kind of economic explanation as to why the Americans get involved against the Japanese in 1940 and 1941. But I think there's an even more important reason. And it has to do not so much with economics, but rather with strategic resources. And when I say strategic resources, I'm talking about things like chromium, things like magnesium, tin. I'm talking about rubber, because we didn't have synthetic rubber yet. We're going to develop it during the war, but we really didn't have it before the war. And consequently, these are the ingredients, these are the materials that you need to fight a war. Okay? And we knew this, that if we did get involved in a war with Japan, that was certainly a possibility. We needed those resources. We had to prevent the Japanese from gaining control of those resources. And by the same token, the Japanese understood that they needed those resources, and they would want to deny them to their potential enemies, the United States and Great Britain and Holland. And there was another resource as well. That was at least as strategic as it was economic, and that's oil. Okay? You can't fight a modern war without oil. You can't fly planes without oil. You can't sail those ships, at least by 1941, without oil. The Japanese wanted to guarantee themselves access to that oil, and the Americans wanted to make sure that the Japanese would not have access to that oil. And so in 1941, the United States effectively embargoed oil to Japan. We froze Japanese assets. In other words, Japanese assets in the United States and American banks could not be used for the purchase of oil. And for the Japanese, that was intolerable. And as a result, the Japanese began to plan for Pearl Harbor. For the Americans, the issue was security. It wasn't so much economics, it was security. For the Japanese, the issue was their ability to continue their war, their major land war on the Asian continent against China. And as a result, as the Japanese planned for Pearl Harbor, they managed to pull off a very, very skillful operation in December of 1941. So I offer you then what is, I think, more of a strategic than an economic explanation of why the Americans and the Japanese are going to find themselves at odds in December of 1941. I want to turn back to Europe for the next few minutes. In April of 1940, I said that there had been sort of what was called a phony war on the European continent. But in April of 1940, about 6 months or so after Poland had been defeated, Hitler organized, planned, and prepared for an attack into Western Europe. Initially, in Norway. The British attempted to defend Norway and did so in a very, very inept fashion. They then attacked, the Germans attacked Denmark. Denmark was, of course, immediately north of Germany, a small country, a population of fewer than 5 million people, had no effective way to resist the Germans. The Germans, over the course of just 4 hours, marched into Denmark and occupied Denmark without any opposition. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. And then from there, the Germans prepared in May, on May 10th to be exact, of 1940, an attack on Belgium, an attack on Holland, an attack on France. Mies Gijp, who is a Dutch woman, describes waking up on the morning, early in the morning of May 10th, being awakened by the sound of planes. Well, they often heard the sound of planes, but not such low-flying planes and not so many planes. And then she heard thunder. And of course, it turned out that the thunder that she heard living in Amsterdam was not thunder at all, but it was the explosions of German planes dropping bombs. They were, among other things, going to destroy, virtually entirely destroy, the industrial output of Rotterdam, which was the second largest of the Dutch cities. They, of course, then occupied within a period of 4 days Amsterdam and so forth. But the Germans also used that attack on Holland and Belgium as a kind of entree into France. In World War I, the French had resisted for a period of more than four and a half years. In World War II, the French resistance lasted for all of about 5 weeks. It's a question why the French collapsed to the extent that they did so quickly that historians have been asking for a long, long time. There are a lot of reasons, and I'm not going to get into the technicalities of those reasons right now. Suffice to say that the French were demoralized and that the French, especially during May of 1940, did not utilize a strategy that in any serious way confronted the German ability to not only attack, but when there was then some French resistance, to counterattack those French forces in a very, very effective way. In June of 1940, the French fought more effectively. They fought rather effectively. A lot of German commanders commended the French for the degree of resistance. But by then, in a sense, it really was too late. By June of 1940, certainly by the end of June, the French were going to collapse. And what you have here is, among other things, the Dunkirk evacuation. There were British soldiers who were aiding the French. But in June of 1940, those British soldiers evacuated, beginning in the early part of the month. They evacuated back to England. There are about 330,000 soldiers who the British evacuated from Dunkirk, which is right up on the English Channel. Okay, 330,000 soldiers. They had to leave their equipment behind, but they were able to manage to get back to England. And they were brought back to England utilizing every conceivable ship, naval craft, fishing craft, pleasure craft. The English mobilized all of the different kinds of ships that they could in order to move those forces back. About 230,000 of those men were themselves English. The rest came from other countries, including, I might add, some French, including, I might add, some Poles and others. Nevertheless, the point that I want to make here is that what Churchill is going to call the British the finest hour, the finest hour, okay, because the British did they did avoid capture of all of these soldiers by the Nazis. By the same token, once Hitler was in control of France and of Holland and of Belgium, he began, among other things, the roundup of Jews, the restriction on the activities of Jews and so forth, in other words, restrictions that would eventuate in the Holocaust coming to all of those countries as well. Now, Let me just kind of make a couple of observations. That war in Western Europe in 1940 was a war of movement. It was a mobile war. We call it the Blitzkrieg, okay, the lightning war. Blitz meaning lightning, Krieg is the German word for war. The lightning war. And I want you to think about what we have said regarding World War I. World War I was anything but a lightning war. World War I was a static war. The two sides, for years, were essentially confined to deep trenches. And they would bombard each other. They'd occasionally, charge the other's line into the machine guns and so forth and so on. But for the most part, progress was negligible. They remained in their fixed positions for quite literally years. That wasn't the case in World War II at all. World War II was a war of movement. It was in every sense a mobile war. And that mobile war was in many ways a product of the strategy of German tank commanders, a product, in other words, of the development of the tank in such a fashion as to allow for the taking of literally miles and miles of territory in any given year. The losses were, of course, going to be correspondingly great as a result of that. About 50,000 German soldiers died in the attack on France. About 50,000 French soldiers died defending France. Nevertheless, however great those numbers may seem, much, much less than the kind of numbers that we were comparing them to in World War I. British aid to France, in other words, proved to be relatively meaningless. You see that the result of that aid, right here. And what? That's the. I'm going to talk about the Battle of Britain. But before I talk about the Battle of Britain, it's about 10 minutes after the hour. I'm going to give you about a 6-minute break. So why don't you get up and stretch a little bit? We're not going to break as long as we normally do. And then we're going to come back. And then I want to talk about the Battle of Britain. And I want to talk about Stalingrad. And I want to talk about Pearl Harbor. You have here, Winston Churchill. This war is going to be won by the Allies, in part because of Winston Churchill. Churchill became Prime Minister of England after the disaster in Norway for the British. Okay, around May 1st of 1940, the British Parliament brought Churchill in to be the new Prime Minister, and the old Prime Minister, who had promised peace in our time, departed. Churchill made a difference. Churchill shored up British confidence. Here was a man who understood language. Here was a guy who understood that through the voice, through words, through language, you could, in a sense, take a country that was already quite demoralized and inject a kind of confidence, inject a kind of elan and enthusiasm for the conflict that became absolutely critical. I think that Great Britain's ability to survive the Battle of Britain when the Germans were going to attack almost every night, attack British cities, okay? Almost every night, attack British cities. I think I'm going the wrong way here. Yeah, I am, when I go the other way. To attack British cities, like London, Coventry, Birmingham, Manchester, and so forth, okay? What the Germans were seeking to do was, having defeated the French, to knock the British out of the war. It would essentially end their work. It would end their work in Europe. They didn't succeed in doing that. The British succeeded. And how did they succeed? They succeeded, among other things, by, number one, protecting their population. You see St. Paul's Cathedral over there. By the same token, you have over here people living night after night for months and months in the subways. They called it the tube. Living in the subways during the Battle of Britain, they were willing to do that. They weren't demoralized, and the reason they weren't demoralized is because, in a sense, Churchill gave them reason for believing that they would ultimately win the war. He was the least defeatist politician, I dare say, in all of World War II Europe. 60,000. Civilians, 60,000 British civilians were killed by these German raids, and still the British continued to they continued to resist. Well, how did they manage then to survive? And I think they managed to survive through a couple of things. Number one, because the British developed the use of a weaponry that became terribly important in their operations, and that was radar. Radar was originally, I think I mentioned earlier, it was originally developed by the Poles and then by the Germans. And the Americans had developed radar. The British had developed radar, all of them in the latter part of the 1930s. But the British used radar in a very, very effective fashion, which is a way of saying that they set up a system of radar stations. I stress and underline the word system. They systematized the use of radar in such a fashion that they knew when the German planes were 200 miles away, when those planes were coming and where they were likely to be flying. And as a result, the RAF, okay, the RAF meaning the Royal Air Force, was able to meet the Germans and to destroy hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of German bombers, okay, hundreds of German bombers, to such a point where Hitler was finding it difficult to replace not only the bombers, but to replace the flyers, the pilots who flew those bombers. And as a result, the British would defeat the Germans in the Battle of Britain. That's when Churchill would say, "Never have so many owed so much to so few." And those so few were the RAF flyers who had helped to defeat the Germans. When Germany lost, when Hitler failed to win the Battle of Britain in December of 1940 and January of 1941, he then turned his attention to his next objective, which was defeat the Soviet Union. I said a few minutes ago, remember, that the Germans had signed a non-aggression pact, a neutrality pact, a non-aggression pact with the Russians. Hitler cared as much about his signature as he cared about those Jews and those other minorities, racial minorities, that he disdained in Europe. And in June of 1941, on June 22nd to be exact, on June 22nd of 1941, the Russians would be attacked by the Germans. And you can see some of the relevant figures right up here. About 3.4 million German soldiers, think about that, about 3.4 million German soldiers attacked the Soviet Union. And Stalin, the Soviet leader, was in large measure unprepared, psychologically unprepared. I think there's a case where he did not want to believe the reports that he was hearing, because there were plenty of reports that the Germans were massing on the Soviet border for what would likely be an attack on Germany, an attack on Russia during that period. 3.4 million German troops, 3,600 tanks, 2,700 German aircraft. And so the Germans attacked on June 22nd. They attacked on June 22nd in what eventually was going to become, I think, probably the largest, the most important single mistake that Germany made in the war. Because the Russians were going to survive that attack. They were going to last through that attack. Okay? I think there are a couple of mistakes that Hitler made. Mistake number one, that he attacked at all. Okay? He didn't have to attack, and he did. A part, I think, of his old hatred of communism and his hatred of the Russians generally. And secondly, and not unimportantly, he divided his forces. He divided his forces with one half of his army heading toward Moscow and the other half of his army heading toward the Ukraine, which was really the breadbasket of Russia, the breadbasket of the Soviet Union during that period. And so he divided his forces, and consequently, when the Russians did mobilize, when they finally did, in a sense, get themselves together, after huge, huge losses of both men and materiel, they were able to prevent the Germans from succeeding. They were able to prevent the Germans from occupying Moscow. The Russians would lose a large number of men, over a million, during that first 6 or 7 months of the year. But the Germans would also lose close to a million men, which is, roughly speaking, about just over 25% of the total number who had attacked in the very first place. And of course, by December and January, December of 1941 and January of 1942, the Germans were beset not only by Russian armies, but they also had to deal with the Russian winter. Just as Napoleon had been defeated by that winter back in 1812, so now the Germans were going to be defeated by that winter, or at least stopped by that winter in 1941 and into 1942. Again, it's difficult for us to understand the discomfort, to understand the difficulty, to understand the degree to which, literally hundreds of thousands of German soldiers and Russian soldiers would wind up suffering frostbite and the loss of limbs as a result of all of that. It was an incredibly destructive campaign. The Russians placed over 2,000 of their own troops in a hospital that was designed for only 200 people. And of course, the Germans didn't even have those kinds of hospitals to bring their troops to. A very, very, very difficult time for both parties. And Hitler makes another mistake, which I'll tell you about in just a moment, because I want to shift for again just a little bit to that Pacific War. At the time, at roughly the time that Hitler is attacking the Russians, the Japanese begin planning for Pearl Harbor in the summer, in other words, of 1941. And finally, they attack Pearl Harbor in December, on December 7th of 1941, a day that, as Roosevelt puts it, a day that will live in infamy. Now, we know why the Japanese attacked. I kind of outlined that a little bit earlier. What I want to note here, however, is that the attack could have been a lot more serious from the American perspective than it turned out to be. About 2,600 American sailors are going to be killed at Pearl Harbor. Many men are going to die. Many others are going to be injured, are going to be wounded. Many ships, including battleships, battle cruisers, destroyers, are going to be sunk by the Japanese. It was a very, very well-planned attack. The Japanese, among other things, had developed a shallow torpedo. In other words, a torpedo that could be dropped from a plane into relatively shallow water and then, make its way to its target. A year earlier, the Japanese did not possess such a shallow water torpedo. They had done their homework in respect to, knowing where the ships were going to be located. But two things were going to make that Japanese attack a lot less serious than it might otherwise have been. Number one, the Japanese sunk no American aircraft carriers. And the reason was because
yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
Now, I mentioned, number one, the carriers were not sunk. And the carriers were not sunk because the carriers were not there. The carriers were at sea. Why do I mention this? Because there was nothing more important to American victory in the Pacific War than our aircraft carriers. Secondly, I want to note that not only were the carriers not sunk, but moreover, the Japanese failed to strike. They failed to strike the dry docks. Okay, they failed to strike the dry docks in Hawaii, and those dry docks were exceedingly important because the Americans were going to repair most of the ships that had been struck by the Japanese in a period of 6 to 9 months. A few of the ships were beyond repair, like the battleship Arizona. But most of those ships were repaired. And as a result of that, the Americans were able to, in a sense, get back into action in a way that becomes very, very palpable in the middle of 1942, only 7 months after the attack. The early going for the Americans and for the British were not very propitious. The Dutch as well. Okay, during the very first days of that Pacific War after December 7th, the Japanese would occupy Singapore. They would defeat the British. They would occupy the Philippines, which was an American possession. They would occupy the Dutch East Indies, where they were receiving about 40% of their oil. They needed that oil to continue the war. Okay, so they occupied these areas. And by the same token, the Americans in the Philippines were not only defeated by the Japanese, but in many ways humiliated by the Japanese. You see over here, okay, this is the Bataan Death March. 76,000 prisoners, it says. About 11,000 of them were Americans. 7,000 of them would die in this 60-mile, 70-mile march that they were forced on. And the way in which they were treated was nothing less than brutal. This wasn't war atrocity stories. This was the real thing. The Japanese beheaded many of them, tossed many of them into the path of oncoming tanks. Many of those American soldiers, and of course the Filipinos who were joining them, died of starvation. This was war in its worst form, okay? And the Americans are not going to forget that. They're going to pay the Japanese back. In fact, I would make the point right now that the war in the Pacific was in many ways a racial war. It became a racial war. The Japanese mistreated the Americans, and the Americans in turn would, they would return the favor. When I was visiting Pearl Harbor a number of years ago, back in 1988, I was toured around Pearl Harbor by a sailor who was there in December of 1941. It's one of the reasons why he was a tour guide. After Pearl Harbor, he was then sent out with many of his fellow sailors into the Pacific onto some of the island campaigns. And there, among other things, he found American GIs who had been skinned, possibly alive, but literally skinned by the Japanese. And I hardly need tell you that from that point on, he said, we would not take Japanese prisoners alive. In fact, he was crying, literally crying, when he told me that story. It was a very, very bloody war, a very, very difficult way to begin the war. General MacArthur left the Philippines. He went to he was the American commander there. He went to Australia. Some would argue, his critics would argue, that he fled to Australia. MacArthur became a very polarizing figure during the war. He had his champions, but he equally had his detractors. But the larger point I want to make about this war is that in the Pacific, and you can see it right here, Little Midway, 7 months after the war began in the Pacific, 7 months after Pearl Harbor, the Americans, knowing that the Japanese were sailing to Midway in order to take Midway as part of a program to eventually capture the Hawaiian Islands, the Americans met the Japanese at Midway in one of the most important battles of the entire conflict. In fact, I would argue one of the two most important battles of all of World War II. One of those two battles is going to be Stalingrad. I'll talk about that in a moment. The other is going to be Midway. At Midway, American carriers faced off against Japanese carriers. The two fleets never caught sight of each other. Okay, it was the first battle that was fought, naval battle that was fought exclusively in the air. The American fleet never saw the Japanese fleet. The Japanese fleet never saw the American fleet. The Americans were battered by the Japanese during the first 2 days of that battle. But on day number three, the Americans caught the Japanese. American fighters called the Dauntless, dive bombers, caught the Japanese when Japanese planes were on the decks of their aircraft carriers refueling. The Japanese planes were not in the position to take off, and the Americans not only sunk three Japanese carriers that day, another Japanese carrier the following day, but of course destroyed many, many of those Japanese planes even before they had gotten into the air. It was a decisive battle. I would call it the turning point of the Pacific War. After Pearl Harbor, the assumption was that, and this is based on conversations between President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill, the assumption was that the Americans and the British would first defeat Hitler, they'd fight a war in Europe, and then, after Hitler had been defeated, they would turn and they would fight the war in the Pacific against Japan. But after the Battle of Midway, they changed that strategy, and they decided to attack the Japanese even in 1942. And very, very shortly after Midway, the Americans, in August of 1942, would attack the Japanese at an island not very far from Australia called Guadalcanal. It was a very, very bloody fight. And it would last for all of 5 months, literally, from about August until the latter part of November of 1942. A very, very unpleasant, a very, very difficult battle for the Americans, where one historian describes the soldiers on both sides being beset by, among other things, naval guns, heat, insects, disease, crocodiles, and food shortages, not to speak of fear. There are a lot of American casualties there. 3,100 casualties. 30, I shouldn't say that. 3,100 men killed in action, okay? Marines and naval personnel killed in action at Guadalcanal. So many that the United States government would not admit for years, would not publicize for years the numbers of Americans who were killed at Guadalcanal, okay? It was a very, very difficult and a very, very bloody battle. But the Americans defeated the Japanese, and it really ended the possibility of the Japanese expanding any farther than they had already expanded in that area of the world. And from that point on, the Americans are going to begin what was going to be called a process of island hopping, where they would move from island to island to island, Tarawa to Truk to Tinian to Kwajalein and to Saipan, and eventually to Iwo Jima and eventually to Okinawa, so that they could attack Japan directly. It was a program that was designed and that was largely directed by Admiral Chester Nimitz. That's a name I want you to remember, Admiral Chester Nimitz. One of the great war heroes, not as well known as MacArthur because he didn't have the public relations of MacArthur. He didn't have the huge ego of MacArthur, but he was a very, very effective naval commander. And what he did in the Pacific ultimately would turn out to be a lot more important than what General MacArthur was to do in the Pacific. So the Americans, as I say, were going to move from island group to island group, the Solomon Islands, to the Marianas, to eventually to the Carolines, to Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and so forth. And by the time they got to Okinawa, they were in relatively short flying distance, about 600 miles flying distance to the Japanese mainland. And what they were going to do to that Japanese mainland was as destructive as any other single element of this Pacific War. Now let me turn, if I may, back to Europe. I said that there were two key battles in this war, the two most important battles, not two key, but the two most important battles. One of those battles was Midway. The other of those important battles, really important battles, was Stalingrad. Okay, Stalingrad, which was fought beginning in the fall of 1942, and which would be continued right until the early winter of 1943. So let me talk a little bit about Stalingrad because, as I say, it was really, in some ways, the most important single battle, I suppose, of the entire war. I said a moment ago that the Americans lost 3,100 men killed in action in Guadalcanal, and because of the sizable losses that we had suffered, the Roosevelt administration would not publicize those figures, wouldn't be publicized until the very, very end of the war. At Stalingrad, the Russians were going to lose over 150,000 men killed in battle. They were going to suffer over 350,000 men who were going to be wounded in battle. In other words, 500,000 casualties, not 3,100. And they were going to suffer another 500,000, another 500,000 men who were going to be prisoners of war. The scope of the battle, the number of losses, the intensity of the fighting dwarfed anything that was occurring in the Pacific during those years. So, you know, as we compare American losses to Russian losses, let's understand that the real burden of this war during this period was being carried by the Soviet, In fact, let me offer you, if I may, a statistic that may put a little bit of this into perspective. The Soviets would lose during the war about 27 million people killed. About 27 million of their citizens would be killed. That includes soldiers, it includes sailors, it includes flyers, and it also includes civilians. The American losses in the war were not 27 million. They were a total, including disease, of 410,000 men. 410,000. In other words, we suffered only a slight percentage, only a very, very small percentage of what the Soviets lost. And you can understand, you know, with those statistics, why Joseph Stalin is going to argue, number one, that the Americans and the British are really not doing their part, and number two, why it's absolutely necessary for the Americans and the British, and eventually the Canadians, to open up a second front, in Europe. In other words, a front directly on the European mainland. We are going to do that, but not in 1942, when we initially expected to do so, not in 1943, when we hoped to be able to do so, but rather in June of 1944. From Stalin's perspective, we were deliberately delaying things in order that the Soviets and the Germans would exhaust themselves. In any case, after Stalingrad, which more or less ends by February of 1943, the Soviets went on the offensive. For the first time against German armies, the Soviets would go on the offensive, and they would remain on the offensive throughout the duration of the war, beginning in 1943 and continuing into 1944, and finally ending when Soviet troops and American troops met on the Elbe River in 1945. They would fight in the summer of 1943, those Soviet and German troops. They would fight the largest tank battle in world history. It was at a place that most of you, I suspect, have never heard of. It was called Kursk. If you know something about military history, you know Kursk. It's spelled K-U-R-S-K. It was a city somewhat east of Stalingrad. The Russians mobilized 3,600 tanks in that one battle. The Germans mobilized 2,400 tanks in that battle. And by Kursk, the Soviets were developing a tank which we're going to know as the T-34, probably the most capable tank in all of the Second World War. The Russian spies had already notified the Russians that the Germans were going to mobilize at Kursk, and so the Russians were ready for them. And at the very, very same time that the Russians were defeating the Germans at Kursk, the Germans were also laying siege to Leningrad. Leningrad was the Soviet had been the Soviet capital. It was named after, of course, you know, a Soviet Bolshevik hero, Lenin. And it was not so much a battle, but a situation in which the Germans sought to starve the population, about 3 million people, 3.5 million people in Leningrad. And they quite literally laid siege to the city. They allowed no one out, and they allowed no food in. Their object was quite literally to starve to death the entire population of the city. And in heroic ways, the Soviets were able to ultimately break that siege, partly by establishing a kind of land bridge across a frozen lake in the winter called Lagoda, a land bridge that allowed the Soviets to at least bring some food back into the city. And finally, in 1944, Soviet armies on the movement west, in other words, advancing beyond Kursk, were able to force the Germans to finally end the siege at Leningrad. But again, it gives you a little bit of a sense, I think, of the utter destructiveness and in some ways the perverse quality of the way in which certainly Hitler was fighting that war. You see on the right, General Marshall. You see on the left, President Roosevelt. These two men, okay, who had a huge amount to do with the ultimate American victory in the war. President Roosevelt was a war leader who allowed his very, very capable generals to fight that war. And I would argue that of a bunch of very capable generals, including Eisenhower, including General Patton, to a lesser extent, I think, General MacArthur, certainly to include General Omar Bradley, a number of others perhaps that you've heard about in this war. The most impressive of all was General Marshall, was George C. Marshall. He did not fight in Europe. He did not command American troops in Europe. He was in Washington. He was the overall military commander. For all intents and purposes, he made most of the important decisions, or at least endorsed or okayed most of the important decisions of the war. From my own perspective, he's one of the two or three greatest Americans of the entire 20th century. I don't think he has a lot of competition. I think that Roosevelt is some of that competition. I think that Martin Luther King is some of that competition. But I don't think that one should underestimate the importance of Marshall, to underestimate his importance in respect to fighting this war. Marshall wanted to open up a second front in Europe in 1943. He was finally overridden in part by events, by the fact that we in the United States did not have enough landing craft. You can't carry an army from Great Britain to the European mainland across the English Channel without landing craft. Without the ships in which we can place the men in such a position where those guys can get onto the beaches in a relatively safe fashion. So without those landing craft, we finally postponed that landing until 1944. However, in order to satisfy the Russians, what Roosevelt did do was to authorize a landing in Africa. And that comes as early as the first week in November of 1942. And then from Africa, after the Germans and the Italians had been defeated, Roosevelt is going to authorize, again on Marshall's recommendation, a landing in Sicily. And then from Sicily, a landing into Italy. They anticipated that these landings would be relatively easy. Okay. They were not easy at all. They were not easy at all. The fighting in Italy was very, very protracted. The number of miles gained in any given day were really minuscule, really tiny. We landed at a landing at Salerno, another at Anzio. All of these landings went much less favorably than we had anticipated. And among other places, we fought at Monte Cassino. This is what Monte Cassino looked like before the battle, and this is what it looks like after the battle. It was a medieval castle, where the Americans believed, wrongly as it turns out, that the Germans were using for observation and that the Germans were using to house some of their men. And so, although the advice was very, very split, there are some Americans who felt that we should attack Monte Cassino, there are others who felt that we should not attack it at all, that it was an old historic structure. The fact of the matter is that those who argued the case for attack won the argument. And they simply destroyed that cathedral. And we gained very little because the Germans had not been using it before the attack. After the attack, the Germans did use it because it was up on a hill. It was on a mountain. It was about 1,600 feet above sea level. And consequently, the Germans would use that for observation, further slowing down the American and the British advance in Italy. And I might also add that, you know, while we had some outstanding military commanders, we had some military commanders who weren't so outstanding. Most notably, I think, is General Mark Clark, who was the American commander of troops in Italy. And at one point, against the orders of a British general who had command of, you know, overall responsibility in that area, Mark Clark took his army, rushed toward Rome so that he would get credit for having liberated Rome, in fact allowing then a huge gap where much of the German army that was on the defensive in Italy was able to escape and to fight another day. In other words, his vanity proved to be very, very lethal for a large number of American troops in subsequent weeks. So I guess the point that I'm making here is that the war in Italy was a slow war, and in many ways, not terribly important in terms of the overall American victory. Had we not fought in Italy, would the Germans have moved the troops that they had there to France? The answer is, yeah, probably. And it might have made D-Day a lot more difficult than it was. Nevertheless, the point that I want to make here is that it was a very, very slow war, a very, very slow war until finally, we were to attack the European continent at D-Day. I want to offer, if I may, a little bit of statistical information. And I'm going to do this in the context of asking, why do we win the war? Why didn't the Germans win the war? You know, why didn't the Japanese win the war? Why did the Americans ultimately win this war? Having said nothing yet about D-Day, having said nothing yet about, you know, the bombing of Hamburg and Dresden that I mentioned earlier, the fact of the matter is that we're going to win the war in large part because of our industrial potential. This was a war of industry. I said at the very, very beginning of this lecture that it was a war of industrialism, that it was a war of industry. And what I mean is the following, okay? What I mean is that the United States, in 1942 alone, during the entire war, is going to build over 48,000 planes. Okay, 25,000 tanks. Now, what I said, you know, during the entire war, by the end of 1942, those are the numbers. Okay, by the end of the war, these numbers are in the hundreds of thousands. American industrial capacity, I repeat, American industrial capacity is as important as any other single factor in the ultimate Allied victory. Okay, in the ultimate Allied victory. Lend-Lease, in 1941, Congress passes the Lend-Lease Act. The United States is going to provide to the Soviet Union, to Great Britain, to other countries, military equipment. You can see some of it here. Okay? Without that equipment, would the Russians have won their war against the Germans? Probably. Later, at higher cost. Could the British have survived with all of that Lend-Lease aid? The answer is, I doubt it. Okay, I really doubt it. By 1944, 45, about 70% of British equipment was made in the United States of America. What I'm arguing, in other words, is that you can't underestimate the importance of American equipment. In 1939, there were 29 shipyards in the United States of America producing military ships, you know, naval ships. By 1945, there were approximately 322 shipyards. Maybe I shouldn't say approximately. 322 shipyards producing naval craft. And I might also add that these shipyards and these factories producing planes and tanks and trucks and jeeps and artillery and so forth and so on were at work 16 hours every day, two full shifts every day, an eight-hour shift, and then another group of workers would come in, many of them female, I might add, because the men had gone off to war in Europe, okay? And you'd have another eight-hour shift. But we were not yet using three eight-hour shifts. We could have. In other words, we could have increased our industrial production, by a factor of roughly 50% from what we were already doing. So, you know, when you think about the war, I don't want you to only think about it again in those John Wayne military terms. I want you to think about it in economic terms. I want you to think about it in industrial terms. And there's another way in which that industry was very, very important, and it's this. In 1941 at Pearl Harbor, Great Britain was the senior partner in this Allied coalition, and Winston Churchill was making most of the important decisions for the Americans as well as for the British and the Free French and others. By 1943, by the end of the year, okay, 2 years later, the United States was now making most of those decisions. President Roosevelt, George Marshall, General Marshall, were making most of those important. And Churchill understood by December of 1943 that his country had become no longer a first-class power, that his country had become the junior partner in this Allied coalition. So what happens on the battlefield, to a certain extent, reflects what was happening in those industrial cities in the United States, cities like Akron, cities like Detroit, cities like Chicago and Toledo. What was happening, in other words, not only in the most important metropolitan centers, but in many, many other, second tier cities in the United States: Mobile, Alabama; Pascagoula in Mississippi; Norfolk, Virginia, the home of fleets and shipyards and so forth and so on. Don't ignore, in other words, the industrial side of this whole story. Let me also note something else, and that is that the war is a total war. Americans, even on the home front, are fully brought into this war. Not only those British who had to duck from, and live in the subways, to protect themselves against German planes and so forth, but in the United States. I'm old enough to remember World War II, and I'll tell you, among other things, what I remember. I lived in a little town called Woodbridge, which is in New Jersey. It was at that time a little community. Today it's a lot bigger. And back in that period, my father, who was a civil defense official in Little Woodbridge, when we would hear air raid sirens go off, we would prepare for the possibility that the Germans were, in fact, flying over our little town. To this day, to 2012, when I hear our fire siren in the evening, or when I hear that fire siren at other times during the day, I think of those air raids. We would have to draw the blinds down. We would have to darken our houses. We'd have to put out our lights. Cars would have to stop. And by the same token, we were all subject to rationing. And when I say rationing, I mean rationing of meat, rationing of sugar, rationing of dairy products, rationing of newspapers, rationing of metal products and so forth. I would myself, at the age of 4 and 5, go on the trucks that were collecting, literally collecting, the newspapers and the tin cans and so forth that people were leaving out. And you were leaving it out for the war effort. In my little town of Woodbridge, probably, I would say, 80 or 90% of the people who lived in that town, who owned their own homes, had what were called victory gardens in the back of their homes, okay? So we would grow our own vegetables. We would grow, those kinds of crops that we could grow so that, other crops, commercially grown crops, could be shipped abroad to our army and to the people in places like Great Britain, of course, and elsewhere after 1944, who could utilize them, who had less than we did. In other words, what I'm saying is that the war was a total war. The effort was a complete effort. And I am not aware, again, I was 4 or 5 years old at the time, so I hardly want to say that there was no complaining about this kind of rationing, but it was understandably a community project. It was understandably, in other words, a war in which everyone had a stake. And when you consider the fact that there were 16 million Americans who were in uniform during that war, both men and women, okay, and many of them, 400,000 of them, died during that war. Another, 1.2 million who were wounded during that war. I think you can get a little bit of a sense of what I mean when I say that this was, in every real sense, a community effort. And I should also mention that if we were suffering from the fact that we didn't have enough meat and we didn't have enough gasoline, so that, you were restricted in where you could drive and how far you could drive and who could drive where and so forth and so on. If we were restricted, you can imagine how much more serious, how much worse it was in those European communities that were likewise facing shortages. Not only shortages, but shortages to the point where by the end of the war, people in Holland, people in Germany, were quite literally dying of starvation, literally dying of starvation. That's how short they were of the kind of supplies that we more or less take normally for granted. Let me say, if I may, something about the war in the Atlantic. Britain is going to survive because of the Battle of the Atlantic, because they're going to win the Battle of the Atlantic. The Americans are going to survive effectively because we helped the British win the Battle of the Atlantic. What was the Battle of the Atlantic? It was the battle in which the Germans mobilized hundreds upon hundreds of submarines to sink American ships carrying goods to England. That's what it was, okay? Our ability to supply the English was going to be challenged by the Germans, what we call the Battle of the Atlantic. The Germans were furiously building submarines, and they would eventually send those submarines into the Atlantic in what were called wolf packs, not in individual submarines, going after individual ships, but rather entire packs of submarines going after ships to make sure, in other words, that those ships had much less of a chance of survival. And yet, those ships did survive. And why did they survive? And the reason they survived is, I think, for two reasons. Number one, because we had developed in World War I and we would perfect in World War II what we called the convoy system. Instead of sending a single ship across the ocean in a zigzag pattern to avoid the submarines, we would send maybe 30 or 35 or even 40 ships across the ocean. And we would ring those ships, okay? We would ring those ships with destroyers, with submarine chasers filled with carrying depth charges and so forth. And we would seek to identify the location of those submarines by flying surveillance, by flying, in other words, reconnaissance planes that could then identify the location of the submarines. And if I may say it, we did a very, very good job of that. So that the number, the percentage, the tonnage of Allied shipping that was going to be sunk by the Germans is going to drop precipitously beginning in the middle of 1943 and continuing until the very end of the year. Indeed, by 1944, we were sinking many, many more subs than the Germans could build. They simply could not replace the submarines that they were losing. And I might add, not only were we doing this in the Atlantic, but we're equally sinking Japanese submarines at much the same rate. So that the Germans and the Japanese eventually had to simply, in a sense, give up the effort of trying to, you know, prevent us from resupplying in the Atlantic, Great Britain, and in the Pacific, the Philippines, and other areas as well. In other words, what the Battle of the Atlantic did was to shift the balance of power in respect to submarine warfare. And the result of that, of course, was that we guaranteed that all of that lend-lease equipment that I was talking about before was going to make its way to Great Britain. I want to talk a little bit, if I may, about D-Day. I said to you a few minutes ago that the progress, the American progress and the British progress in Italy was slow. It was difficult. Okay, it was hilly country, mountainous country. We had not fully prepared for that kind of warfare. We had underestimated the ability of the Germans to resist the kind of forces that we were utilizing. Some of our planning was really not very good, and I've already made a comment about the quality of American leadership in Italy. Not as great as certainly it should have been, certainly that we believe it should have been in retrospect. By the same token, during that entire period of 1942 and 43 and into 1944, we were preparing for the eventual landing in and on the European continent. The Germans assumed that that landing was going to be at Calais. Calais is the shortest distance, about 22 miles, between France on one hand and England on the other. It made sense to think that that landing would be in Calais. We encouraged the Germans to believe that that landing was going to be at Calais in France. And we encouraged them to believe that because we created a kind of phony army. We created a decoy army with decoy tanks and decoy trucks and so forth and so on. The Germans had every good reason to believe that that landing was going to be in Calais. But in fact, the landing was going to be in Normandy, a little more distant, but the Germans were unprepared for that landing. And the element of surprise was superb, because when German soldiers at what was called the Atlantic Wall, in other words, this defense perimeter that the Germans had created, that they had built along the entire French coast, okay, that when the Germans looked out from that, from that Atlantic Wall, okay, was an Allied force that took them completely by surprise. There were approximately 5,300 or 5,400 ships in that Allied force, which on the early morning of June 6th of 1944, the Germans discovered heading toward France. There were five different beaches where we were going to land. Two of those beaches were English beaches. That is, the English army would land at each of those two beaches. One was a Canadian beach, and two were American beaches, one named Utah and the other named Omaha. At only one of those five beaches was there very serious German resistance. And if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, you have a pretty good idea of what that resistance entailed. There would be, on that first day of the battle, over 800 Americans killed, about 3,000 Americans wounded on Omaha Beach alone. And there were other casualties on those other beaches, but nothing like the numbers that we're going to, you know, view at Omaha Beach. Nevertheless, the larger point that I'm going to make here is that the Germans were unable, partly because of American and British bravery, partly because of American ingenuity to scale cliffs where the Germans were located, where the Germans had some of their, you know, best anti-aircraft guns and so forth and so on. We were able to do that. Partly, we're going to succeed because the German Air Force, by 1944, was largely non-existent. What was left of the German Air Force by June of 1944 had been pulled back into Germany, the RAF. And the American Air Force had done such a very, very good job destroying German planes that what the Germans had left, they had pulled into Germany in order to defend their own cities. And they did not have an air force that was capable of defending their own positions at Normandy. In other words, on D-Day, the Germans lacked air support. And without air support, I think it's fair to say that the Allied victory was inevitable. Quite literally, the Allied victory was inevitable, given the degree to which German air power had been largely destroyed. And consequently, once the Allies had a firm foundation, after that D-Day invasion, and while it took them quite a number of weeks until they finally busted out, they broke out of that Normandy area. In fact, their advance on Germany was going to be inevitable. There were two moments during the remainder of that war in Europe that were problematic. Number one was at a place called, well, it was in the Netherlands. It was called Operation Market Garden. And here again, it was an American disaster. Some of you may have seen A Bridge Too Far. Okay, some of you may have know already a little bit about that operation. It was a very, very, very poorly planned operation. It was an operation that was very, very complicated, where American and British soldiers were going to try to capture a number of bridges over the Rhine River. You had to have those bridges in order to easily advance into Germany itself. But it was very complex. It involved parachute drops. It involved capturing all five bridges, not four of the five. It involved perfect weather. It involved the ability to resupply our troops. It was very, if any one of these elements went wrong, if any one of these elements did not work, the operation was likely to fail. And the fact of the matter is that a number of these elements of the operation did fail. We lost a lot of men unnecessarily. It was a disaster, and it was an avoidable disaster because I think that particularly General Montgomery, the British commander who had largely designed this operation, had done a perfectly awful job. And finally, I would note the Battle of the Bulge in December of 1944, the capture of Paris, the liberation of Paris in 1944. And here's the Battle of the Bulge. This is what the Germans did in the Ardennes Forest between France and Belgium was to surprise the Americans and to surprise the British. And they did so rather effectively, and for about a month, it was kind of problematic as to who was going to win this battle. But eventually, the number of American troops and the amount of American supplies, and most importantly, American control of the air, American superiority in the air. I've already mentioned that the Germans really had lost their air force. Okay, what they had in that area, what was left of that air force, was destroyed here at the Battle of the Bulge. And the Germans lost almost every single one of their tanks at the Battle of the Bulge. So when this battle finally ended in January of 1945, there was really nothing that stood between the Americans and the British on one hand and eventual movement into central Germany on the other. So what about that Pacific War? While the Americans were winning the war in Europe, while the Americans were winning and the British were winning the war in Europe here, what about that Pacific War? Here you see the Americans and the Russians who were meeting together at the Elbe River in 1945. The Russians had been moving in, of course, from the east, the Americans and the British moving from the west, and of course they finally met at the Elbe River. But there was another war, okay? There was another war. This is the VE Day in May of 1945. Hitler had committed suicide about a week earlier.
To the people of the Philippines, whence I came, I shall return.
That was General MacArthur. He did say that he would return when he left Corregidor in 1942, and he came back in 1944. But I want to say two or three things about his return. Number one, in respect to what you're looking at here, there's a good deal of public relations. Someone is in front of him taking those photographs. He had the photographers already there. He wanted this kind of a photograph to be broadcast. Number two, it comes as a result of a stunning American naval victory at Leyte Gulf, which is right in the Pacific. The largest naval battle in history, okay, the greatest naval battle in history was going to be won by the Americans in Leyte Gulf. And that naval battle destroyed, you know, what was essentially, okay, almost everything that was left of the Japanese Navy. When I say what was left of the Japanese Navy, I mean among other things, the Japanese would lose about three additional carriers, major carriers, four what they called escort carriers. In other words, the Japanese had very, very little left. It was absolutely crystal clear who was going to win that Pacific War after the battle at Leyte Gulf. And with the loss of all of their carriers, with their ability, in other words, the end of their ability to effectively deal with the Americans on the sea itself, the Japanese turned to kamikazes. Okay, they turned to a form of warfare in which their pilots would fly on a one-way mission with the nose of the plane filled with explosives. And of course, the object was to ram the plane into an American ship. They did so. Thousands, indeed tens of thousands of American sailors were killed. Probably about 30,000 sailors were killed over the next few months by this kamikaze tactic. But ultimately, it was unsuccessful in stopping the Americans. There were two great battles to remain in the Pacific. One was at Iwo Jima. The other was at Okinawa. Yeah, I think you saw here just a moment ago. This is Mount Suribachi in Iwo Jima, that very, very famous photo of the Marines planting the flag on top of the mountain. About 7,000 Americans were killed in that battle. Another 7,000 to 8,000 would be killed at Okinawa, which was a little bit closer to Japan. These were very, very, very difficult battles. I might add that there were 29,000 Japanese who died at Iwo Jima, and a much larger number of Japanese who died, close to 100,000 who died at Okinawa. Think about this for a second. If that's the way in which the Japanese would defend these two little islands, how would they defend the Japanese mainland itself? How many Americans would die on a direct attack on the Japanese mainland? And so the decision to utilize atomic weapons, you can see, among other things, this is the atomic weapon that was used in Hiroshima. This is the atomic weapon that was used at Nagasaki. And there's your atomic bomb. So the idea of using atomic weapons really was not from the American perspective. We were developing the atomic bomb ever since 1942 as part of what we called the Manhattan Project. It didn't take a genius to understand that the Americans, once they had the weapon, were planning to use it. Would they demonstrate it first? Some scientists said we should do that. There were some military figures who argued that we should first demonstrate it. There are others who feared that the demonstration would not be impressive enough, and consequently they argued against the case. They argued against the case for a demonstration, and the result was the end of the war. We dropped the bombs on the 6th of August of 1945, on the 9th of August of 1945, but I want to say something which is too often forgotten by Americans who believe that we won the war because we dropped these atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that is on August 8th. On August 8th, one day before the Nagasaki bomb was dropped, the Russians entered the Pacific War. They had a non-aggression pact. They had signed a non-aggression pact with the Japanese, which now they simply reversed, which they now ignored. And so if it wasn't clear that the Japanese were going to lose the war because of the way in which the Americans were advancing on the Japanese mainland, it was certainly clear that the Japanese had no choice after the Russians joined the war. And so on, roughly speaking, on August 14th, August 15th, depending which calendar you're using, the war ended in the Pacific, and of course the formal surrender on the battleship Missouri on the 2nd of September. So that's the story. That's the survey of the Second World War. There's a lot to include. There's a lot that I have not really talked about at all. There are some wonderful books that I've used in my own research on this war, books by, for instance, Gerald Weinberg, books by a fellow named Max Hastings called Inferno, another by a man by the name of, a historian by the name of Andrew Roberts called The Storm of War, and many, many other really first-rate histories of the Second World War, biographies of some of the major players in that war, some of the generals like MacArthur and Eisenhower and Marshall and others, and of course, you know, some of their British and their Japanese and German counterparts. It's a very, very important story, and in many ways, the life that you are living in the year 2012 was profoundly shaped by the outcome to that war. Thank you very much for your attention, and to the C-SPAN audience, I bid you well as well. Thank you. See you on Wednesday. Papers in tomorrow, 4:30.
Next week on Lectures in History, Professor Matthew O'Brien looks at the causes and repercussions of World War II. Professor O'Brien examines Hitler's advance through Europe and Winston Churchill's strategy to fight the Nazis. This class took place at Franciscan University of Steubenville in Ohio. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.